This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the most universally recognized word on Earth? The answer is okay. What's the second? Coca-Cola. Coke is the world's most widely distributed product. These facts come from the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola by Mark Pendergrast. His new book is a history of how Coke went from a patent medicine to one of the most successful products in the history of capitalism. Pendergrast says the book was a kind of roots project for him. Both sides of his family are from Atlanta, where Coke was born. His grandfather owned a drugstore where he served the soft drink to Coke's first tycoon. And family legend has it that his grandmother rejected a marriage proposal from the man who later headed Coca-Cola. Well, let's start with the question everyone always asks. Was there really cocaine in the original formula?
Yes, there was cocaine in the original formula, although the company did not put it in the form of powdered cocaine the way we think of it. Cocaine, as you probably know, is the principal alkaloid of the coca leaf, which has been grown and chewed by the Peruvian Indians for thousands of years. And what John Pemberton, the inventor of Coca-Cola in 1886, did was to use fluid extract of coca leaf. And that meant that it had a relatively small percentage of cocaine in it. I have that in the book. It's about 8.5 milligrams, which is per drink, which is so such a small amount that it really wouldn't do much of anything to you. However, if, like many of the people that I found in my research, you drank four or five glasses in a row, you'd get about, 40 milligrams, which is definitely enough for you to feel, especially when it's combined with the much higher proportion of caffeine that it had in the original drink.
Well, what was coca leaf extract doing in Coca-Cola in the first place?
Well, in the mid-1880s, there was a veritable coca mania, as one of the drug journals of the time put it. It's interesting that Sigmund Freud was looking into the wonders of cocaine, in fact wrote an entire book about it, at precisely the same time that John Pemberton was playing around with it. Pemberton had another more personal reason for being interested in coca leaf and cocaine, which was that it was being touted as a sort of a methadone of its time to get people off of morphine addiction, which was extraordinarily common, and which Pemberton himself had. He was a morphine addict.
Now, when Coca-Cola was invented in 1886, it was invented not as a refreshing beverage, but as a patent medicine. What was it supposed to be good for?
Well, let me say, it actually was invented also as a refreshing beverage. In fact, the words refreshing and delicious and refreshing were in the very first ad Pemberton made, but it was to serve a dual purpose. It was also a patent medicine. And it was supposed to cure headaches, hangovers, make you think more clearly. It was called a brain tonic and a nerve tonic. It also was supposed to make you more sexually stimulating, make you live longer. It did just about anything, like many of the patent medicines back then were supposed to.
Well, we've talked a little bit about why there was some cocaine in Coca-Cola. The cola in Coca-Cola was originally cola nut.
That's right.
Which was where the caffeine came from?
Yes, that's correct. Cola nuts are chewed by West African natives to this day the same way that coca leaves chewed by the Peruvians in the Andes, and with very same effect. It gave a quick jolt of energy, and it's also very embedded in their social customs and their religious rites and things like that. It's kind of interesting that both of these products were embedded in their culture and had a religious significance, because I argue that that's precisely what Coca-Cola is to us.
Why did the creator of Coca-Cola feel that there needed to be caffeine in it?
Well, he regarded it as a pick-me-up. You know, Coca-Cola was sold, among other things, as a, quote, intellectual beverage. An intellectual beverage. It was aimed at businessmen and students. So if you were all nervous and strung out and you were having a hard time during your day, you take a minute and drink a Coca-Cola and it would brace you up and make you think more clearly. And clearly that's what caffeine was good for.
Does the advertising campaign, the pause that refreshes, date back at all to when Coca-Cola was supposed to be a pick-me-up and was supposed to be a tonic medicine?
No, the pause that refreshes was invented by a man named Archie Lee in 1929 for the first time, and it really was a product of the Depression more than anything else. The idea was that you took a pause and it would refresh you and pick you up, and it was something kind you could do for yourself during a very difficult time in American life. But it does harken back. In fact, all of their ads continually harken back to the roots that we've just spoken about.
Well, cocaine was still legal when Coca-Cola was first made, but I believe it was like in 1901 or something that it was outlawed?
Actually, cocaine was legal until 1914 with the passage of the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act. In 1906, it became highly unpopular, however, with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which made you list it if it was an ingredient. And because it was then socially not a good thing to take, it was sort of the death knell for any of these patent medicines that still had cocaine. Coca-Cola had taken out most of the cocaine in 1901, as you mentioned, and they got all of the rest of it in 1903. So Coca-Cola has had no cocaine whatsoever since that date, although they still do use coca leaf in Coca-Cola today. It's just decocainized first.
What's the point of the coca leaf today?
Well, supposedly it adds a bit to the flavor. It's part of the traditional formula, and Coca-Cola is, if nothing else, a very traditional company in many ways.
So was the cocaine taken out in 1901 because it was already becoming unpopular and the manufacturer kind of figured out it would probably become illegal soon?
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons why they took it out. It was interesting. One of them had to do with a government lawsuit. Actually, Coca-Cola was suing the IRS for back taxes. The IRS had said that Coca-Cola was a medicine, which was taxable during the Spanish-American War, whereas soft drinks weren't. Coca-Cola argued that it was a soft drink and, in fact, won the case, remarkably enough, even though they had all this advertising, which was clearly medicinal. But I think that helped them to take the cocaine out. The other reason had to do with racism. Because Coca-Cola began to be bottled in 1899, it kind of democratized the drink. Up until then, it had been primarily, in fact, only a drink served in soda fountains for white, upper-middle-class people. And with blacks drinking it, there were a lot of rumors that black cocaine fiends were raping white women and assaulting their bosses and things like that. And Coca-Cola was under a great deal of pressure as a Southern drink to take the cocaine out for that reason.
When did Coca-Cola go from a patent medicine to a soft drink?
It was a gradual process that began around 1895 when Frank Robinson realized that he could sell a lot more Coca-Cola by appealing to the masses with just a popular soft drink than he could with a medicine to people who weren't feeling well. And it was a gradual process that really solidified, I would say, in 1911 to 1920. In 1911, the government sued Coca-Cola and almost put it out of business. A guy named Harvey Wiley, who's quite an entertaining character, was the primary moving force behind that. And it was after that trial that they really abandoned all of their medicinal claims. And it was Archie Lee, the man that I mentioned, who really took Coca-Cola into its golden age of advertising, who realized that the image of Coca-Cola, the sort of upscale social image or a drink which made everybody's life better, that would promote social good times and things like that, was more important actually than the taste.
Once Coca-Cola became a soft drink and no longer made the patent medicine claims, did they have to do anything to improve the taste once they were trying to market it on the taste?
Mm-hmm. No, they didn't change the taste. They have changed the formula at various times for various reasons, but the taste remained pretty much the same. It's interesting you mention that because Coca-Cola has always had this sort of mysterious patina to it. A little bit of sin mixed in with that. You know, there are still rumors that if you take Coca-Cola with a couple of aspirin, it will get you high, that sort of thing. And it's it's not an identifiable taste. It's not grape. It's not lemon. It's not orange. It's a little bit difficult to tell what it is. And I discovered during my research that it is an acquired taste. And the company recognizes this, which is one of the reasons they give away free samples. It's only about the third time that you begin to really like it.
How did you figure that out?
Well, because I found all these quotes from people around the world comparing Coca-Cola to the taste of a burnt comb, or the Italian communists after World War II compared it to licking the leg of a recently exercised athlete. It really is an acquired taste. And a lot of the company people who worked in Brazil or in France told me that personally.
Well, you also managed to come up with the original formula for Coca-Cola. How did you manage to get it? This is really one of the big guarded secrets of American culture.
Yes, and let me say that I am virtually positive it is the original formula, but there's no way to prove that unless you can compare it to the formula which is sitting in the company's vault at the Trust Company of Georgia, and they're not about to let me do that. But I came up with it because I was in the Coca-Cola archives one day, and they brought me John Pemberton's original formula book. And as I looked through it, there was one that certainly was not labeled, "This is the Coca-Cola formula." It had a big X on top of it, as a matter of fact. But as I looked through it, I became more and more excited, and I realized that indeed it was a Coca-Cola formula. At first, I thought it was simply a forerunner of the original formula that, you know, he'd been playing around with. But I eventually came up with some validation that it really was the formula. It's a little bit of a long story. I don't know if you want me to go into that sidelight on why I figured out it really was the original formula.
No, that's okay. But I'm still wondering, like, was it a mistake that they showed you this book with the original formula in it?
It's a mystery to me, Terry. I don't know why they showed it to me. I would presume that it was a mistake, yes.
Let's go through what some of the ingredients are. I don't know if you want to give the whole recipe here or just go through some of the key ingredients.
Well, I might as well give the recipe. It's got citrate caffeine. It had extract of vanilla, fluid extract of coca, which was the source of the cocaine. By the way, that citrate caffeine is what came from the cola nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Citric acid, lime juice, a whole lot of sugar, water, caramel to color. And then you had to add in a bit of this flavoring ingredient, the famous 7X formula. And that's made from essential oils of orange, lemon, nutmeg, cinnamon, which is actually Chinese cinnamon called cassia, coriander, and neroli. Now, neroli, oil of neroli comes from a bitter orange blossom, which I believe is grown in Italy. So it would be difficult for people to, and all of that was mixed up with alcohol, and you had to let it stand 24 hours and then drain off the oil part. It really didn't have much alcohol in it by the time it got into Coca-Cola. It would be difficult for anyone to mix this up. Everybody keeps asking me, did I try to mix it up? And I wouldn't really know how to get oil of neroli, and it would be illegal to get fluid extract of coca.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Pendergrast, and he's written a new history of Coca-Cola called For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. Mark Pendergrast is my guest. We're talking about his new book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Coke has managed to spread around the world, and in the history of Coke that you've written, you show that one of the ways they managed to do that was to follow American troops around during World War II. How did they do that?
That is the most amazing story. It's one of my favorite chapters. It's called The $4,000 Bottle, Coca-Cola Goes to War, because at one point during the conflict, they actually auctioned a Coca-Cola bottle off for $4,000. What happened was right after Pearl Harbor, Robert Woodruff, who was the longtime boss of Coca-Cola, they called him the boss, he made this pronouncement. He said, "We will make sure that our fighting men get Coca-Cola wherever they are for a nickel, regardless of what it cost the company." It was a very patriotic gesture. It was also a brilliant marketing gesture. It resulted in Coca-Cola being exempted from sugar rationing during the war. As a matter of fact, the government declared Coca-Cola to be an essential morale booster for the troops. They put Coca-Cola men in army uniforms, sent them overseas. This is all at government expense. And set up bottling plants behind the lines to supply the troops with Coca-Cola. And indeed, you will find when you read the letters that these soldiers wrote back home that it was an essential morale booster. It really did mean a great deal to them. On the other hand, it also meant that Coca-Cola got this incredible worldwide boost, and that when the GIs came home, they came back with a very decided preference and loyalty for Coca-Cola over Pepsi.
So who footed the bill for bringing Coke to the troops abroad? Was it was the military, or was it Coca-Cola?
Well, Coca-Cola continued to pay its men their salaries. However, the government paid for the transportation of the men and the bottling plants overseas. The government paid for the men to be billeted. The government also provided CBs and other men to help them when they needed repair of their bottling plants. They provided prisoners of war to work in the bottling plants, which, by the way, the Coca-Cola men loved the German POWs and much preferred them over the French civilian workers because they worked so hard. But there was definitely a collusion between the government and Coca-Cola during the war.
So meanwhile, while Coke is boosting the morale of American soldiers, Coke is also being bottled in Hitler's Germany.
That's true. Coca-Cola began in Germany in 1929, but it really took off in 1933 when Max Keitt took over. Now, Keitt was an interesting character. There's a picture of him in the book, and he looks remarkably like Adolf Hitler, who came to power that same year in 1933. And I make the argument that he is similar to Hitler in some ways. He was certainly an autocrat who terrified his employees. But he also had this intense belief, not in Deutschland, but in Coca-Cola über alles, which is the title of that chapter. And he pursued it with a monomaniacal zeal. And in doing so, he certainly did collaborate with the Nazi government as much as he could, although he ran into trouble. One of his competitors went for a tour of a New York bottling plant, picked up some kosher bottle caps. In other words, Coca-Cola, which was especially designed, you know, for the kosher Jewish market, took them back to Germany, and he had these printed up as postcards and sent around declaring that Coca-Cola was a Jewish American drink. And the Nazi headquarters canceled all their orders, and they had big problems. But eventually they overcame it through all of the old expedients of simply repeating advertising. It's interesting that Hitler actually learned from Western advertisers, including Coca-Cola. And he says that in Mein Kampf. He says, you know, I've learned from these advertisers that you have to repeat a very simple message over and over again.
Another interesting story about Coke around the world is a story that relates to Russia, where there was a Russian who didn't want to be seen drinking Coke because it was so identified with American imperialism and capitalism.
This was General Zhukov, who was the hero of Russia during World War II. He took Berlin. He ended up being in charge of the Russian-occupied zone of Germany, and he became good friends with Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was a real Coca-Cola addict who eventually ended up owning parts of bottling plants, by the way. But Zhukov, having been introduced to this drink, liked it. And he said, gee, I'd like to have some of this for myself, as a private stock, so to speak. But if I'm seen drinking the American imperialist drink out of this funny little bottle, they'll send me to Siberia. So can you please make it so it doesn't look like Coca-Cola? They made special white Coca-Cola for Zhukov, colorless, in other words, sort of the first crystal Pepsi. And they put it in straight-sided bottles rather than the classic hobble skirt bottle. And they bottled it with a cap that had a little red star on top. I was fascinated by this when I learned this from the man who actually made it for him.
Did anybody else drink this, or was this just manufactured for this one general?
It was just for the one general, but it provided them very ready access to the Soviet-occupied zone. They could go back and forth with no problem, whereas everybody else had to go through this incredible bureaucracy.
Coke and Pepsi have been slugging it out around the world, trying to get new markets in new countries, competing, of course, in the United States. What are they fighting for now? What's the territory that they're most competing for?
I would say that the biggest fight is probably in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union right now. You know, Nixon, who was a former Pepsi lawyer, was definitely a Pepsi man, the same way that Eisenhower and Carter were big Coca-Cola men. And Nixon helped to get an exclusive contract for Pepsi in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc for a long time. That's only recently been broken. And Coca-Cola is pouring millions, in fact, billions of dollars into the area to combat Pepsi. And they are, in fact, rapidly winning that war. You know, here in the United States, Coke and Pepsi are in a real head-to-head conflict that Coca-Cola has clearly, you know, winning. They have about 40% of the market to Pepsi's 30%. But overseas, it's a massacre. Coca-Cola dominates quite thoroughly about, I think it's something like 3-1 overseas. So really, Pepsi is trying to scrabble and hold on in the places where they do have a lead, such as Eastern Europe. Certainly, Coca-Cola is focusing its long-range view on the Pacific Rim. They just can't wait to really get into China and Indochina. They're there, but they, you know, they're building infrastructure. And right now, for instance, China has a one per capita. That means everyone in China drinks one Coca-Cola per year. And if they could raise that to the level of Iceland, for instance, which drinks 396 Coca-Colas per person per year, they would be doing very well. And they say, you know, it's hot there, and boy, this could be a great market. And, of course, they're not particularly concerned about the politics of China, which is something I fault them for in the book.
Mark, did you drink a lot of Coca-Cola growing up?
No, as a matter of fact, I drank very little. My mother wouldn't let me drink Coca-Cola. She thought it was bad for me, that it would rot my teeth and my insides, and that it was full of chemicals. I found out it's not full of chemicals. It's an all-natural product, actually. But she wouldn't let me drink it, and so when I went to friends' houses, like to play football in their backyards, I would go inside and have Coca-Cola, and it was like this wonderful, forbidden, sinful, delicious drink. So it's always had that kind of flavor for me. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Well, Mark Pendergrass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Pendergrass is the author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.